mature person is confident of some things, but is ready to listen, to hear other views, to enlarge their own view.
Even when the Jehovah's Witnesses come knocking on your door?
Yeah.
Even when the Jehovah's Witnesses come knocking on your door?
They've got answers, haven't they?
Yeah, it's good to sit down and talk with them. I have found good rapport with them. I don't always talk to them, because they come back and they come back, and you just can't sit down and talk and talk and talk. But I have had some really good conversations with them. They don't agree with me, and I don't agree with everything they say, but we let it hang out, you know?
I think my experience is they've got everything formulated in a very precise way. If you want to raise another scripture verse, they almost, no, let's stick to these. They know how that fits. If they're really sharp, they've got the answers to how that one doesn't fit into it too. But you don't have to look to the Jehovah's Witnesses. You can look in a congregation and sense people with that rigidity.
Yeah.
You know, introduce a new type of singing. Introduce, dancing, drama, incense. Frankly, I don't care for incense.
Communion every Sunday in our church.
Or communion, wow.
It went out by one vote. Believe me, we've had to pull back now because so many people... I can't understand why would you want to take communion every Sunday? You're misusing it, you know? So that's one of the problems we have.
I actually heard someone say, well, I don't need communion every Sunday.
I know.
The answer is, you need it every day.
I belong to a retreat community that has communion every time we meet.
Yeah.
And to come to Holland where they only have communion on Sunday, it's kind of like, what? this is a religious situation. And it's a matter of perspective, saying. It's whichever way you look at it.
I think small groups, incidentally, are able to benefit by, almost every time you gather, you celebrate it. Because it is a celebration. It's a celebration of your unity. It's a celebration of the presence of God in our midst. And, let me illustrate how I think this works just a little bit more. One of the basic doctrines that most of us believe is the doctrine of the Trinity. And new member classes, I would try to cover this. And the simplest thing is to talk about, one God, but three persons, three in one, and one in three. And God does, the Creator does this, and Jesus does this, and the Holy Spirit does this. And of course, usually, you end up, people go out very confused. They say, okay, if this is the arithmetical formula I have to believe, okay, I guess I'll accept that. But it's kind of, in itself, a lifeless doctrine, if it's only that. But if it's a statement of faith that talks about relationships, I believe discipleship talks about relationships. What you're talking about in the doctrine of Trinity is a relationship to the Creator. And that relationship is one of goodness, of closeness, of purpose. And it's not something that is done by the God out there, because creation is continuing. The Creator is in the process even now of creating, and we're called into a relationship as co-creators. And that if I think of Jesus, seems to me to start talking about, I'm much more comfortable talking about that one who related with people, calling them to the same kind of trust of the Creator God as he had it, trusting that if he lived with integrity, if he lived lovingly, if he challenged what he saw as evil every time he confronted it, and that he's the one that I'm called to live in fellowship with. I'm called to follow him in that. That relational kind of understanding is one that I think we can talk about. And the Holy Spirit, instead of getting hung up on, you know, some definition of that, that presence of the Holy that is constantly with us and guiding us and is comforting to us and is the strength to keep living out our life in discipleship. Now, I find people can understand that and they can say, oh, all that stuff is, what you're talking about is the Trinity? Yeah, that's one thing. But when you start, and it sounds kind of wishy-washy, but I think it is wishy-washy. The doctrine isn't a biblical teaching as such. It's no place in the Bible. But it's every place in the Bible in the sense of relationship. And so, and I think that's typical, that the mature person has beliefs, but doesn't put them in such precision that they limit our understanding. Rather, they're pointers to the broadness of the understanding. The Trinity doesn't narrow down, it's this and nothing else, but it's all this is what we're trying to confess. And so that it's experiential. By the way, was it Tuesday morning that the staff did morning matins? What, some of you were here. That was the morning it was read that God is in the flower that grows and is in the person you meet, and God is in this, and God is this, this, and this. And I think the title of what she read was, What is God? Not who is God, but what is God? Did anybody have any reaction to that? I don't know, many of you. What was your reaction?
He felt that was almost pantheism, close to it anyway, and that while God certainly has created the trees and the leaves and the air and the rain and everything, he's not necessarily in it in that way.
I disagree. He is necessarily in it as the, I'm Jewish. The Jewish Christian, and Judaism, and the Kabbalah anyway, teaches that God is present in his creation in a feminine sense, and it's called the Shekinah. And
then what if you cut down a tree? What are you doing
with that? God goes through into another tree.
Well,
I think
I think as it was read, you said, but God is in, and that's different than saying God is. And see, I have some trouble with theism when it seems to objectify God, especially if we say God is out there. God is a being. I don't really believe God is a being in the sense that God is one being alongside other beings. And that's why Paul Tillich says God is the ground of being rather than being itself. God is not one thing separate from other things. And so, whereas I started, just a moment, let me say that. Where I started, I was kind of pleased when they started reading, but then I got a little bit bothered by the end of it. Because I believe what she was verbalizing was pantheism. God is all things, and all things are God. I kind of gotten where I like the phrase panentheism. That's what they accuse, this is what Matthew Fox argues for, that God indeed is in all things. God is manifested in all things. God is encountered in all things. But God is not all things. The verse in Romans, it says something like, in all things God has worked for good for those who love him. And in some translations it comes out sounding like all things happen because God made them happen and they're good. I don't believe that. Some things are evil, should not happen, and God surely doesn't cause them to happen. But I believe that in all things, every situation, although God is not the cause, in all situations, God can be sensed and experienced, and we can learn something from it, and something can come out of that, which can be good and beautiful. I don't believe that the accident that causes somebody to be killed out there this afternoon is a good thing. I don't think God caused it. But I do believe that we might learn something in and through it. We might learn that we should live each day celebrating, because who knows when that could be our last day. And I believe that, if somebody was killed because they slid down a slippery steps, I think we can roughen up the steps so people don't fly and hurt themselves, like I did. Some couple of hands.
I guess what has helped me, because I've had that same feeling, not from that particular reading, but even from some of what Wes was doing in his Vespers out on the lawn the other day. And I've had an encounter with some people that are involved in this A Course in Miracles thing. And I think one of the problems is that God is both transcendent, meaning beyond our human understanding out there, but God is also immanent and within creation. And I think where we get into trouble, and I think that the people who emphasize immanence have just as much negative to say about us if we're used to thinking of God out there, is that God is both. And if we talk about only the God out there, we aren't talking about God. And if we talk about only the God in here, we're not talking about God in the completeness. And I think I didn't hear all this level stuff. I'm going to have to read up on that. But the whole idea that there's no one description that can adequately describe God, because God is beyond all human understanding. I think I found that concept to be real helpful, that we have to have a balance between a variety of concepts of God, because no one of them will describe him. What makes me nervous is when they sound like they've completely described God. Mm-hmm. And I think that, does that help with how you dealt with that statement or that reading?
Yeah. Yeah. Can I
be more personal rather than abstract? Personal confession. Before I came here, I was feeling really depressed and down and out. I felt like sort of at the end of the line, because I had three publishers in it, and one after another is kind of proven what I call a psychopathic. I don't want to judge them, but I published my first book when I was about 40, and I waited 10 years for the second one. I worked 5 years on it, and it took me 5 years to get it published. It was an awful lot of work. And 2 months after my second book came out, 2 months, this publisher got back, put my book on backlist, though I had many great reviews. That means just listing my name and the title in the back, so sort of saying, if I don't buy this book, then I am protested in like a kind of not very sincere response from the publisher. So your logic is good, but the premise is false. And anyway, it's kind of got me down. And I came here for one reason, for seeking spiritual renewal as well as to give lectures, which I had to make arrangements for with David Wee about a few months ago. And I am feeling, after a week here, a sense of the spirit. I don't think it's just in me, but something in nature and people and sense of community and whatever. Feeling a little bit of the, what they call it, spirit, a tiny bit. And it's sort of a healing, feeling a healing from it. And I'm feeling, I felt that, well, my books were, getting backlisted, other troubles with publishers, maybe they weren't the value, and what I did wasn't the value. Anyway, I'm regaining some little tiny sense of purpose and meaning and so on. And so that M. Scott Peck, whom I met once, said in one of the lectures, he said, I'm a man of very little faith. But then he said, Jesus said, if you have as much faith as a grain of mustard seed, that's sufficient to save you.
The fact that it was a beautiful week here, a beautiful week, I feel like it was God's will that we have such a beautiful week. We had the weather, we had everything in favor of us. But had it rained all the time we're here, we would have found something. God would have been great then too, because he had served, there was a purpose in his rain. So it could have been beautiful. We say, well, it was beautiful. It was God's will that we have a wonderful week.
Not apply to tornadoes and
it, well, we were going to find some good in it.
I don't know about that. I don't think it's God's will. I don't think God's will that it do the Lord. Make things of nature. We talk about acts of God. I don't think it's acts of God.
However, in the tornado, some very fine things may come out of it. We lived in Portland, Oregon in 1961. The great wind that it knocked down trees and knocked, it was, I guess, one of the worst windstorms they'd ever had.
120 mile an hour wind. Yeah.
And, but it knocked out all the service out in our area. And, but we had a gas stove. Everybody had electric stoves around us, and they couldn't cook. So everybody came to our house, and actually, we had three wonderful days. Everybody came to the place. We had more fellowship, more koinonia, more community. Out of that terrible windstorm, which I don't think was God's will,
with candles,
but something very good came out of it.
That was God's will.
That was the occasion for us to discover one another, community. And for years, we all talked about how wonderful it was back during the windstorm, you know. And it's too bad. Afterwards, everybody went their little separate ways. And, no, totally. We had a new kind of experience. Well,
Sharon's company is a great uncle talking about acts of God.
Yeah, right. Acts of God. But the thing you were saying, but this week, you know, we were, but the thing is, if you hadn't come here, you had a lot to do with your experience this week. You came, you know, and a lot of people wouldn't take advantage of it.
Let me shift over to something now. If we look in Matthew and Luke, we find the Beatitudes in both chapters. In Luke, it says, blessed are the poor, they shall see God. Blessed are you that hunger, you shall be filled. In Matthew, would you, in Matthew, Matthew 6, Luke is what? Sure. In Matthew, it says, blessed are you poor in spirit. Or blessed are you that hunger for righteousness.
Matthew is blessed are the poor in spirit, but there's the kingdom. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Blessed are you poor in spirit.
In spirit. Mm-hmm.
Luke says, blessed are you poor. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure, you know, undoubtedly we're referring back to the same comments of Jesus. Most people talk about, you know, it isn't one is right and the other is wrong. But which is the more basic statement? Or if Jesus said it one way and himself didn't say it the other, but that in remembrance it was repeated a second time as the community of faith remembered it. Which you think was the basic?
I like the basic, blessed are the poor in spirit. So.
Do you believe that was the basic way that Jesus said it?
I don't believe that, but it's the way I just love. That's the one I'm most familiar with.
You like
that?
Yeah.
Most of us, it's an enlargement, isn't it? Blessed are the poor in spirit. Actually, though, among most biblical scholars, they would say probably the original saying was, blessed are the poor. But that, and that the other is the way in a later time the Christian community tended to repeat it. First of all, we kind of like it, don't we? I mean, we do like it. Blessed are the poor in spirit. And the humility, the openness, the egalitarianness, all these are virtues. But we also kind of like it because when you come right down to it, I'm not poor. And the poor shall see God. And I'm not poor. Hey, you left me out, Jesus.
No, poor in spirit, Matthew.
And yeah. Luke says, blessed are the poor.
But biblical scholars are quite convinced that the original saying probably, blessed are you poor. Yeah, you shall see God. Blessed are you that are hungry. Yeah, you'll receive food. You'll be filled.
Isn't it that many of those people who are poor, many of those people who are of a different skin color, maybe know God better than those of us who are not poor and white and whatever?
Yeah, maybe you're right. I'm not brown or green or.
Of course, poor could also mean poor could also encompass all of that. If you just say blessed are the poor, it could encompass all of that.
Well, I believe one of the things we as disciples have to really be alert to is that we don't so spiritualize the message that we take it out of the realm of real living. By the way, with Hebraic background, when the Jew talked about, when the Old Testament talked about to be blessed, it wasn't some spiritual blessing by and by. To be blessed is to know prosperity right now. Hey, to have family, to have food, to have to be prosperous, that was to be blessed. It wasn't some spiritualized thing. It was a gutty, earthy experience. And I believe it was that for Jesus too. And I believe, I think before we start spiritualizing it, we need to ground it in that earthy kind of understanding. So that, and you see, I think undoubtedly it says in Corinthians there were not many poor. There were not many very rich that received Jesus. There were not many well-educated people that received Jesus. There were not many people with doctor's degrees. There are not too many millionaires. There weren't many too many church officials that received Jesus. There weren't many presidents and kings. it tended to be the poor or the outsider or the one. And the whole thought there, you know, and why? Why? That's a good question.
If you have it, they had it made.
Yeah. You're self-sufficient if you're rich, aren't you? Hey, if you got a PhD, you could probably, you're pretty well guaranteed of making it. If you're skilled and all, you know, hey, but if you don't really need God, you don't even need other people. Self-sufficiency is so easy. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're poor, if you're hungry, if you don't have an education, if you come from a family background, if you don't have those things that almost guarantee you success, you're open. Undoubtedly, this has something to do with it.
But see, I see the poor in spirit really strong too, because I've gone through a period of time when my spirit was poor because I was overworked and I was just out of it. But anyway, I've seen this happen to many of pastors and many friends of mine, and their spirit does become poor. Something has happened, they're overworked or whatever, and they haven't taken time to nourish the spirit. And I think maybe that happens to all of us. And maybe we don't always realize that. So we are poor in spirit at times. And we need the nourishment. Like coming here this week, you know, has been so great. I feel renewed by being here.
But then to be renewed, are you no longer poor in spirit?
I'm better.
Okay.
I'm better.
Yeah. I think if it means poor in spirit, that yes. Well, here's the question. Can a rich man enter into the kingdom of heaven?
Sure.
And the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm. That would be very difficult.
But watch out, because it's like a camel. Because why do you want to get into heaven for? You got it all right now, you know?
Yeah.
Why do you want anything else? You're not dependent. That's the whole point. And that's why I think discipleship, when I said it's to live in solidarity with the poor, that was one of the points, is that it's to recognize that we are interconnected. We are related. And if somebody's crying, in a sense, I'm crying too.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if there's celebration, I'm celebrating too. And it's that interconnectedness. That's what, and if poor in spirit means to have that kind of humbleness, to have that kind of sensitivity to others. In Luke 15, a rich man came to Jesus and he said, listen, I fulfill all the requirements of religion. I fulfill all the demands of the law. He was a good Jew. He had kept what was required of him. And he said, now, what do I have to do to inherit eternal life? Jesus said to him, that person, well, go sell everything you have and give it to the poor.
Because that was an idol for him. That was something that at that point was more important to him than God.
Mm-hmm.
Question is, if he said that to that man, what does he say to me? And if I come before the Lord and say, listen, now, I've done everything that the Bible tells me to do. I've done everything the church tells me to do. I've fulfilled all the requirements of the law. I've done it all. I've joined a church. I tithe. I regularly worship. I help people out. I volunteer to teach Sunday school. I do. And, you know, it's like, now I've done it all. Anything else? Well, it's, you know, I'm not sure what else, but it's something that says, done it all, and I'm doing all that I can, all that I know how. But it's not taking self-righteous pride in this. And if it is, then I need to be deflated somehow. Jerry, go sell all you have, or whatever it might be. And I guess, is it necessary to go sell everything you have if you're a disciple?
No.
Maybe for some it is and maybe for some it isn't.
Yeah.
Depends on what that symbolizes for them.
I know people who have come as close to giving up everything they have and are living that way, and I honor them and admire them. Although I've met a few who have done this who are so proud of it that I tell them, you know, you're so self-righteous in that you've given up everything, you know. I think that person is just bad as off as the other person. But we have not sold everything. I haven't. Is there anybody here that's given everything away? So how are we then to be faithful? I think that's the question. I think we can, but I think there is a cost to discipleship. And if it isn't selling everything I have and giving to the poor, then what is it? I've tried to say this week that it's to be a peacemaker. It's to live non-violently. It's to live in solidarity with the poor. It would be to be ecologically responsible for, care of the earth. It would be to live in community and fellowship with other people, in relationship, and many other things. That we need to be very careful that I don't so spiritualize discipleship that I miss the heart of what it is. It means, in a sense, a total surrender of myself to follow the way of Jesus as best I can, to be committed to all that Jesus was committed to as far as I'm able, to trust the Creator as much as I'm able, as Jesus did, and that discipleship entails all this and much more. And that I think that an awful lot of us rationalize an awful lot here. And we too quickly say, well, of course, Jesus doesn't mean that we all have to go sell everything we have and give to the poor. Naturally, it doesn't mean that. But we're too quick to... And we're too quick to say that. We need to say, I think it's correct to say it. But it doesn't, but then it means to make a commitment of all of our resources, our brains, our skills, our education, whatever it is, and to use them in the most responsible way in relationship to other people, even our enemies, even the poor.
Are you often familiar with Red and Roses?
With what?
A Bread and Roses.
No.
Well, it's an organization of the poor. It's become nationwide. I know it's statewide, but now I think it's quite nationwide. Now, you go and prepare food that maybe the grocery stores have given to the house, and you prepare the food, and it's for people that are down and out, and they come in. And Al and I worked there for a couple of years, and we enjoyed the work. Really did, when we felt down and out, people came in. But one day, which changed, there are two things that changed our ideas. One day, a young boy came in and sat down and visited with us. He was a 21-year-old, lived in the neighboring town. He sat in a chair like this, and Al and I sat there and visited him. Then he got up and walked around, and when it was dinner time, walked around and took the street entrance into the dining hall for the men. Al picks up the food, carries it down some rickety stairs, and serves the man, the young kid. Elle's a 7-year-old, here's a 21-year-old, and we're serving him. And then Elle picks up, gets it from the kitchen, goes back down the stairs, because you couldn't go outside, it was much too far. And when Roy ate, I don't think he even said thank you to him. He got up and walked out and went out on the street again. That was one occasion. Then, and now I wasn't involved, but I felt, here's a 70-year-old feeding this 21-year-old, and he doesn't even say thank you. And he's the fool. Then another day, and I've been really troubled. I finally got, because it bothered me. Another time we came, and no one there to prepare the food. The organization people had left. It was April the 15th. And so Al and I was supposed, we were supposed to be the servers, but we ended up making the salads, and we concocted some kind of a hot dish. And he and I did this with one other lady that came in. And the people came, and I served the ladies upstairs, and the men were served downstairs, and we did. And I said to the girl, where is everybody? And she went, you know, these are very political-minded people that are running this place. And I said, well, where did they be? Well, they might be down at the post office. So we did. We went down to the post office after the mail was served, drove down there to see what was happening. And there was the guy who was the manager and two of the assistants passing out brochures. And they were passing people not to pay their taxes because the money was going to the wrong places. And they were recipients of that, of our taxes, because it was food given to, but that was still food that was raised by people who were paying their taxes. It destroyed everything there for me. And I've had a rough time understanding. When we talk about give to the poor, you know, I can do that, but when the poor...
There's real difficulty there. So, have you ever belonged to a church where some of its members didn't act very Christian? I've even heard sometimes we pastors are not that perfect in our actions, and some pastors aren't very, very, very good. And,
that the don't pay your taxes people were probably saying, hey, we don't need any more B-1 bombers, and all this military expenditure is inappropriate. And that's probably what they're saying. It's only taxes because of that. And that some of it's going to the places and a lot of it isn't.
I know that. But why doesn't Bob get out there and run for a place where he's going to do something good? You know, if he can change it, he should get in. What are you doing protesting? And that is
when you try to change it in that way, others try to change it in other ways.
Why doesn't he get out and educate those?
That's what he was doing when he passed out the literature. He was educating people.
That's blocking it. That's
there's a story about in a town, there was a river going by this town, and people in the town noticed babies were floating by in the river, and they would come and pull them out. More and more babies were coming down the river, and they would pull them out, and this went on and on, until finally someone said, why don't we find out why these babies are in the river? And they went up to some place where they discovered who was throwing the babies in the river. And in a sense, the places that serve food to the poor are kind of like pulling the babies out of the river, and it's necessary. But to find out, to change the system that's throwing them in the river in the first place, is the thing that's going to stop it. You know, and so in a way, these people felt at least what they were doing was something like that.
Well, I don't know if not pay their taxes was going to do it, but if he get in the position where he could. Those taxes when they come in, and he could get on a committee or something that's budgeting. But he was recipient of our taxes and telling us not to pay them.
Maybe he doesn't want taxes to go to nuclear warfare.
Well, that's understandable.
But
our taxes are going to pay for his property.
But it's so twisted, they don't see that.
You know, so I have a struggle with it.
Maybe.
You know, unless you can get in and change the system, and that's where he should be. You can't.
Well, if you don't pay that, if enough of us didn't pay our taxes, we'd change the system pretty fast.
Yes.
And some people feel that's the most effective way to do it.
He would be the one to suffer if we did, because he was reciprocate of that tax.
Maybe it would be more money than what he was doing if nobody paid taxes, because we could give the money directly to him.
I still have problems with that.
In the Constitution of the United States government, it says whenever any government, I can't quote it exactly, but doesn't meet the needs of the people, it's the right of the people not only to change it, but if necessary to revolt, would do whatever is necessary to change it.
But he needs to get into,
Well, one person will run for one for a political position and try to do it that way. Others will do it another way, and others will do it another way. And this is one of the things I find that when I get into things that I'm committed to, everybody doesn't agree the best way to do it. But I tell you, not to do anything is not the way either. So,
I want about your first point. About the poor not being thankful. Sometimes that hits me too. It's difficult to be helping them. And I guess they feel that they have been failed. The system has failed them. So why should they thank for giving just charity when they feel maybe that they should have right to earn it themselves?
And we don't know what kind of family this young man grew up in.
They don't know how to do things.
Raised by parents who teach us to be polite. We can't expect that any of our dealings with the poor, which they look on as charity, we don't know what kind of resentment and distress they're feeling. So we can't necessarily expect that they're going to
change. Even their embarrassment for being there.
Absolutely, yes.
That's the whole business about when you do it to the least of my brethren, you do it unto me.
Yeah.
That it's easier not to get frustrated if we see those acts of charity as being acts of doing God's work rather than something for which we should get an immediate feedback of reward. But still, it's obviously a lot easier when you do
it. Two of those people weren't even citizens of our country yet. Destroyed everything
just for us. Let's not see the poor as children, but see them maybe as Christ.
Well, let me just. Discipleship. Discipleship is not something that one day you decide, I'm going to become a disciple. Now that's it. Discipleship is a journey. And there will be 1,000 decisions to be that disciple. And there will be 1,000 temptations to desert. And so that discipleship, as I see it, is a journey. That you think you understand it, so you commit yourself to it. And then you discover, there's much more involved than I thought. And so then, you commit yourself to that step, and then something more. Just like our entire relationship to Christ, it better grow. When I was, I made a decision at one point to be a pastor. I thought I knew what that meant. Boy, I discovered all along. And, or all of us, it's a journey, and I'd like to have you think of it in that way, as a journey that keeps unfolding, and that at every point, Jesus stands there saying, come on, there's a task for us, there's something to do, and leads us on further into it.
Can I just say one thing? Yes. One of my favorite sayings is that heaven is not is not directional, it's dimensional. That it's there all around us right now, and there it went to the degree that we can be disciples. Every once in a while you catch a glimpse of that heaven when everything is right, and then it closes me. And in a way, Holden is kind of a glimpse of heaven, you know, and that's all I want to say.
Jerry, you asked me at the last session to do some research on solidarity with the poor. There really isn't time to go into it now, I'm afraid. But I recommend Sojourners, which has excellent things in it, particularly in two sections, which are called Seeds and Connections, giving you ways that you can work to do things, giving you places where you could volunteer for a whole year in your life if you wanted to. This magazine, Seeds, also is excellent. In fact, there was a wonderful section on the problem of the homeless, which we discussed last time too, and things you can do to help the homeless, and that would be to help the poor as well. The catalog that was mentioned by the Mennonite community is advertised in Sojourners in a couple places. There's a wonderful section in Seeds if anybody's really interested in volunteering a year or two out of their life. It gives several organizations and tells what their religious and philosophical background are, the areas in which they serve, typical projects that they have, primary needs, number of volunteers they need, any language requirements, length of service, volunteer benefits, and other comments. And many different organizations are mentioned here. If you can't volunteer for a year or 6 months, they all need support, monetary support, I'm sure. So they're wonderful magazines, and I recommend them highly.
Thank you for looking that up. Yes, I asked you to come in and give that report. And
that's right.
Both Seeds or Sojourners, and each of them have sections towards the end.